Accession number 31393, Reel 2.
Jill Hamilton, Reel 2. In that 2 month period prior to you going operational, can you give me an outline of the training that was involved, that you were involved in, the navigation training, the radar intercept?
Well, it was mainly daily flights, day flights and night flights, using a Blenheim with the equipment, with the radar equipment, doing navigational trips, navigating by radar beacons, doing blind approaches to be able to land in fog, which could be done on the AI as well, and practice interceptions, which were made available by another aircraft acting as a target.
So how do you navigate on the radar beacons?
Well, there were many beacons all over the country. They were all transmitting in Morse different signals, and you could pick them up on the tube as a blip, which was being coded, and it was simply a time base, and the bottom was the zero. The blip was somewhere in the middle. If the part of the echo was extended to the left, you would turn left, you would centralize it. The only thing you had to worry, are you going towards it or are you going away from it? But that was easy. if you turn left and it did the wrong thing, you knew you were flying opposite. So that was the first exercise, to bring the aircraft home safely over the beacon, or fly from beacon to beacon. And the second exercise was using two beacons which were at the beginning and the end of the runway, which had to be lined up so that almost similar what you would do on the ILS, but you would do it visually. So you would tell the pilot to go left or right or to start to descend. You knew the distance, you knew the range. He would then know at what range, at what height he should be at what range. They used to call it anchor approaches. Don't know why, code word. And that was the training. And the next phase was intercepting aircraft. So they always provided a target, and the ground radar would navigate us within a range of about 6-7 miles. And hopefully I would pick it up on my tube, on my radar tube, and then we would say punch, which means I've got a contact on my radar. And when you were satisfied that you could take over and complete interception, you would say Judy. The ground radar would give you no more instructions, and you would guide your pilot into visual range, which was usually about 200-250 yards. And believe me, in the darkest night you can see silhouettes, and we knew the exhaust position of different aircraft. Enemy aircraft, we had all these silhouettes with exhausts. If it had two exhausts on the left or both sides, we knew that it would correspond to Junkers or Dornier or a Heinkel or whatever. So that was the training. And once you have done sufficient hours, which was in those days, I think 30 hours, that's when Max Eklin said, you want to be operational, you can start flying.
Can you describe the AI equipment as well?
The AI equipment consisted of two radar tubes. One was the azimuth and the other one was elevation. Both had a time base. The azimuth had a time base up and the elevation horizontal. Whenever you picked up a signal or an echo on the time base, in other words, when the aircraft was within the range of your aerials, it would also appear on the elevation tube. And because the antennas were fixed on the leading edge of the wing and the nose of the wing, it would then make the echo either bigger at the top or bigger at the bottom. So you would know he's above us, he's below us. And if then you centralize it all, you would know he's either the same height, dead ahead. Now, you would know the range of the blip, which was closing to the zero line, to the baseline, and you would know the range. So then you switch over to a more, a finer range. So instead of having 3 miles, you went to 1 mile, you went to 2 yards, and then you could say, well, he's now 500 yards, 400 yards, 200 yards, 12 o'clock, about 10 degrees, 12 o'clock high, and the pilot was, yeah, I can see him. So then it was up to him.
So the role would be, you would monitor the aircraft until literally it was...
Until he obtained visual contact, we were never, ever allowed to shoot anything down unless we could identify it. That was the requirement. And when he obtained visual contact, my duty was to stay on the radar in case he lost it, because he might have seen us. He was starting to do a lot of jinking and try to keep with him. But normally when you obtained a visual contact, you were around about 200 yards behind him, slightly. Always the pilot wanted to be slightly below, about 10 degrees below the tail of the aircraft.
Can you describe to me the Blenheim Mark IV in the night fighter role? What it looked like?
It was just an ordinary Blenheim Mark IV with the AI fitted into it. That's all. You were sitting side by side, where in a bullfighter you were with the back. But it was purely for both of us to be able to see the effect of the radar. So if I looked at the radar and I could see the aircraft as well, in daytime, don't forget, we could do that in daytime interception, you could learn very quickly how to behave when you see the movement of the echoes on the tube. I mean, if I saw a picture on the tube and I would say to the pilot, go left 10 degrees or go up or down, I could see visually that it was corresponding to what I could see. That was to get confidence, really. That was the main reason. There was nothing special about the aircraft. That we didn't carry any ammunition or anything. It was just purely for training.
Where were the guns in it? Were they underneath or in the...
Not on the Blenheim. On the bullfighter, there were four cannons underneath in the fuselage and six machine guns in the wings.
What about the Blenheim? Where was it?
No, we didn't have any guns in there, because that was purely for training. We didn't use that for shooting aircraft. Purely, we had two Blenheims, and they were only for training navigators and pilots to become an efficient crew.
So at that stage, when you went operational, you went on to a bullfighter?
Oh, yes. Straight onto a bullfighter, yes.
Can you describe to me the kind of organisation of the squadron? Who was in charge?
We had a commanding officer who was always a wing commander. We had two flights. The flight commanders were squadron leaders. They're always a rank higher than the day fighters for some unknown reason. So they commanded more people, because there were always two people in each aircraft, and Spitfire was just one. And we had two flights, A and B flight, which were the operational flights, and the C flight, which was the training flight. And, you know, we were on duty we were on duty every night when we were required, different flights. We had a night duty one night, and we were on day duty. The flight which was not on night duty did a day duty in bad weather, because we were used in bad weather when the Spitfires couldn't see. And we alternated between that. So it was a continuous on and off. It was in the summer. Our night was comparatively short, from 10 o'clock till perhaps 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning. In the winter, it was from 4 o'clock till 8 o'clock in the morning, so it varied.
And you say every night. Would it be every night, or would you work a set period and then...
No, every night, every alternative night for a flight, but you would still do day flying. You would incorporate into practice gunnery, air-to-air on a drogue, or air-to-ground. They would have to be done all in daytime. And night flying air tests, NFTs, have to be done before you go on readiness. So there was plenty flying to do up away from the operational flying. But, we were on duty every other night. The flight was on duty every other night, while the other flight was doing the day work.
And when you were sent on a night patrol, were you chasing individual targets, or were you given an area?
No, when you were sent off, normally it was a scramble. If they could see a stream of bombers coming for a target, excuse me, I'm trying to clear myself, you would be vectored or directed into the bomber stream. Preferably at 90 degrees, and you hopefully would pick up a target. and then lock on it, or not actually lock on it, but you would pick it up and you would tell the ground that you got a target. And when you finish, either you shot it down or not, or you lost it, they would then try to get you into something else. And they would usually say there's 50 plus, or on the occasional night there might be just one or two enemy aircraft doing a reconnaissance. So it varied. Mostly, if there was a takeoff, is usually a developing bomber race. So we were at Kotyshov, we would go halfway on the North Sea between London and Holland, try to intercept them to go, hopefully to get it done before they dropped the bombs, because they would have been slower. Not always possible.
In saying that, although you would be directed to that, how easy is it to make contact and keep contact with an aircraft?
It was difficult then. It was difficult. It was a bit of a hit and miss. They would direct you, obviously, on their ground radar as best as they could, giving you as best as they could establish the right altitude. But because our range was up to about 5 or 6 miles on the Mark IV AI, it was highly probable that you would pick up a signal if you're heading for a bomber stream. I mean, the bomber stream, they would have been well spaced out. But if they would normally pick up one particular target, the ground station, and try to lead you onto that to get a contact. And once you got a contact, it was in the... I mean, as I said, we used the code words, punch would have been that we have got a contact, but we're not certain whether we can keep it. And Judy was, yes, we're taking over. And they would shut up and let us get on with it.
And if you did make contact with something, would it be the case that they would often see your aircraft as well?
No, we had what was called a cockerel. A cockerel was a coded signal which was sending an radio emission which could be seen on the blip, coded. So they would say, if you go into a group of, they used to call them unknown aircraft, would be called bogies. Bandit was a known, bogey was unknown. They would say, make your cockerel crow. You switched on the IFF, identification friend or foe, and if I picked up a signal and it was bleeping the right code, I knew it was one of ours, so that was easy.
And if it was a German aircraft, would they be able to see you as a night fighter?
At the beginning, not. Definitely not, because all the ones that I was lucky to intercept, there wasn't the slightest indication that anybody was aware of us being behind them. No, definitely not. Later on, yes, I think. But as we operated over home countries and the sea, I don't know, the German knife fighters developed fairly quickly after us, but they had one disadvantage. I think it was called Liechtenstein Gerät. It was the German AI. German airborne radar, they had one disadvantage that it used to burn out very quickly. Sort of after 20 minutes they had to shut down, where we could keep ours on for 2 hours. We did have, of course, blow. Some of them have blown up and you had to come back, like all, radio and electric things. It can't be 100% reliable. But basically our radar was extremely reliable, and you could leave it on for the whole duration of the flight, which was good.
What would be the kind of average duration of a
flight? Average duration was about 2.5 hours. That was in conjunction with the fuel we carried. We could stay up 3.5 hours, but 2.5 hours would be the operational. 2 hours would be the chasing operation time. You could finish up 40 miles from the Dutch coast and you had to come all the way back with headwinds and so on. So you allowed yourself good time.
And with this role that you're in, you're also navigating as well,
aren't you? You're navigating as well, yes. You can... Well, later on we had G-boxes, of course, so that was very easy. We had also different AI, different airborne radar. Mark 4, Mark 5, Mark 7, Mark 8, and we finished with Mark 10. A more sophisticated range up to nearly 10 miles, so it was a great help. Better definition, better interpretation, and different tactics. The business of chasing aircraft behind him was ridiculous, because a German bomber who dropped his bomb, he would then go into a shallow dive, he would pick up a hell of a speed. You know, you try to pick up a bomber gaining overtaking speed of about 10 or 20 knots, you nearly cover the whole North Sea. So then they were intercepting collision course interceptions, where the ground would try to put you on a collision course, 90 degrees or even head on, it doesn't matter, and you would know at the right time, it was all worked out by the mathematicians, you would know at the right time at which point to turn. And if you carried out the interception, you should finish up dead behind him. Didn't always work out. But it was pretty good.
Can you take me through, obviously, your first operation? How you felt with that first time you went up there to do it?
Well, I felt great. I just wanted to get a hold of some bandits and you know, shoot something down. But there was a lot of activity over Liverpool, Coventry. Plenty activity there from High Erco. I mean, and then we were moved to Coltishaw. There was plenty activity in London. So there was always something to chase, but it didn't always result into you know, a positive success. But some nights we had a very successful night, other nights we chased things. We chased also balloons, which was highly dangerous. But you could tell, because the closing speed of a balloon on the radar was the speed of our aircraft. So I learned very quickly, if it's closing too fast, there's no way that a German bomber would be so slow. So we avoided that.
Were balloons the only hazard that you'd have to avoid?
Yes, I think so. And friendly bombers returning from Germany. Sometimes we were actually told to intercept them and flash our lights and lead them perhaps to the nearest field like Coltishaw where they could crash there. And I brought in many Wellingtons and many Lancasters and flying fortresses as well, which were in Dutch trouble, and they were able to land as quickly as possible at the nearest airfield. But you have to be very careful, because I was very weary of the air gunners. You have to really flash your lights. And we had, of course, varied pistols. We could fire the right colors, and they changed every 2 hours. It was green and red, or white and red green, so we could identify ourselves.
Was there ever a threat to yourselves from the kind of German intruder aircraft?
Yes, there was, actually. I remember one day at Coltishaw, we were scrambled in daytime during a very rainy day. We were just lining up to take off, and I could see a Dornier dropping bombs at about, he must have been flying about 1,000 feet. And I remember my pilot said, the sooner we get off the ground, the better. Yes, they did cause a little bit of trouble, but not too much.
Are there any incidents that stand out when you intercepted and shot down some aircraft?
Yes, the incident which I remember more was the destruction of the first German four-engine bomber, which was a Heinkel 177. The reason for that, quite difficult, because we have never seen one. And when we intercepted it, sort of about 40, 50, 60 miles from the Dutch coast, and got a visual on it, it looked a huge aeroplane, but it didn't look anything that we have seen. So we have to break radio silence, which was dangerous because it was also within the German fighter zone. And we said, what shall we do about it? We described it. And within a few seconds, well, it was sounded a long time, but it was a few seconds, the intelligence officer said, it is a four-engine bomber. If you look very carefully, the two engines are enormous. There were two behind each other, so you could see only two engines, but there were actually four engines. It's got a huge wingspan and a very high tail, and the order was shoot it down. And as soon as we opened fire, the rear gunner opened fire. But we were only about 500 to 800 feet above the water. And he went to a sparrow dive. And I think later Max Etkin found it. They found some debris. The British Navy discovered some debris. So that was a bit worrying, sitting behind an aircraft which could possibly be shooting at you in a bright, you know, moonlight night. I turned my seat around and I looked at it. I said, I've never seen anything like it. That was one experience. Yeah. The other one was, of course, a Dornier, which was, he was going home from, I think, from Norwich, after bombing Norwich. And we picked him up straight near Yarmouth. And I locked onto him, and he was going slowly, slowly down, up to about 200 or 300 feet. We went below him and got into closing range. It was a Dornier 217, and fired at him. Oh, I think we must have fired only about 6 bullets. He exploded, and that was horrible because we were actually hit by a small debris. We peeled off, and I remember his aircraft hitting the sea, going into a, so almost like a flamethrower, I suppose the fuel exploded. So that was a bit hair-raising, flying very low at night over the sea, yeah.
Was there ever a threat from anti-aircraft guns as well?
There was. There was a great threat because there was the anti-aircraft zone defending London and there was the fighter zone. And we were not really allowed to go into the anti-aircraft zone because they were just firing, but we often did, and it was dangerous because you could be shot down just as easily as the Germans. And when we did break the law, it was at our own risk, you know. Yes, it was great.
Would that be often something that you would do to pursue aircraft?
We would. Once you got an aircraft and you were 200-300 yards behind him and you were going into the flag zone, there's no way that we would break off and let him go. We would just go in and try to get a kill if possible. Yeah.
What type of aircraft were you operating against? You mentioned a couple of the aircraft there, but what was the usual type of German bomber that you would encounter?
Oh, the usual type was a Ju-88. Dornier 217, later 217E, a very slow Heinkel 111. After the Coventry Blitz and Liverpool Blitz, the Ju-52 was not used, it was sitting duck. It was really too slow, even slower than our Wellingtons. So it was mainly the three. As we didn't deal with day fighters, so we didn't worry about Messerschmitts and Focke Wulfs, so it was mainly the Dorniers, the Heinkels, and the Dornier, Heinkels, and Junkers, the three.
And would the German gunners sometimes see you? You mentioned obviously with Heinkel
1-7. Yes, they would, and they would spot us. Not very often. I think there are only very few incidents on the squadron where they've actually been fired. It was like a cat and mouse game. I mean, you sneaked behind. Don't forget, most of these interceptions were done really on the route when the Germans were going back. They delivered their bombs. They felt quite safe. I mean, the one that we shot down at 300 feet, he was about 40 or 30 miles from the Dutch coast. They put their cabin lights on. They felt absolutely safe. they felt, oh, it's the Dutch coast, we were clear. And suddenly, you know, bang, the whole thing exploded. I remember the right engine catching fire and blowing up, and so they must have been surprised.
In the early stages, when you're doing in 41 and 42,
yeah.
Were you aware of the marked successes of the night fighter squadrons? That there was an increase?
Yes, there was an increase drive to improve the AI, the radar, as they call it, aircraft interception. And we did get new models. We had a new model of the Bowfighter Mark 6 instead of Mark 1, and later, of course, the Mosquito. Better navigation, like the G-Box, which we carried, and the Mark 8 radar was very successful. It was based on an entirely different system than the one I described to you. It was one tube, and you picked up a signal, which was either a half a moon or a little moon. If, in other words, to explain it quickly, if you closed the signal completely and made it a circle, he was in his gun sight completely. So whichever he went, up or down, it was very easy to maneuver. And it was so accurate that in daylight we could actually operate in clouds. But again, we're supposed to recognize him first.
Can you give me a kind of thumbnail sketch of the Bowfighters that you operated as an aircraft, what you felt about them?
I think the Bowfighter was a very solid, well-made aeroplane. I felt very safe in it, although they called it was a killer. But I think you had to respect the aircraft. It took a lot of punishment. We have seen a Bowfighter, or we have seen Bowfighters, we've been shot at and riddled with bullets, and everything was fine. The engines, sleeve valve engines, not ordinary sleeve engines, they were Hercules engines, very quiet, that's why they call it the whispering death in the Far East, very reliable. I think we had only one failure, and it would fly reasonably well on one engine, no problem at all. Yeah, I felt it was a good aircraft. We could rearm in the air. I could get off my seat, put another set of drums in the guns, so that was another advantage. We couldn't do all that in a Mosquito. And plenty of room. We had an armored-piercing door between me and the pilot. It's supposed to have been closed, but we never kept it closed because I like to see him and make sure he's still there. But that was a good aircraft. A lot of people grumbled about it, but I think it was a very well-made, and it was, I think, the very first aircraft which was made to serve as a night fighter.
You mentioned quite a few things about its characteristics. Was it its solidity and its strength that was the main?
Solid. It was metal. It was no wood on it. It was solid. It was. I don't know what it weighed. 10 tons or something. It was extremely good aircraft, but it had its vices. You had to respect it. You know, the pilot had to really respect it. And we had, unfortunately, three crews were killed. In Côte d'Azur, we had a bad luck. We had one every week. Well, one took off and exploded because the ground crew didn't shut off didn't put the caps on the petrol things. One aircraft tried to intercept a Liberator, trying to do a night flying test, which was crazy. We were told, don't go behind Yanks, they're trigger happy. And he sneaked behind him and waved his wing. The air gunner opened fire, so they had to bail out. Yes, it was a good aircraft, but it was not fast enough to keep with the Germans. When they brought the Messerschmitt 410, I was glad we had Mosquitoes then, because the Bowfighter would have been too slow.
In the same way, can you give me your impressions of the Mosquito?
The Mosquito, very maneuverable, very fast and very efficient aeroplane. Very, very cramped inside. I always said the man who designed it had no intention of sitting in it. The radar had to be pulled from underneath towards the navigator. Even climbing in, climbing out was very difficult. But it had the speed. and we needed the speed because by that time the Germans had faster aircraft, and it was very good. And I liked it. I was sitting in the front with the pilot, and I could see exactly what was happening. But it was a good aircraft, but I still preferred a war fighter.